Okay, so I guess we can start. And we have arrived at section number 511 in the Mahapranibbana Sutta. And so for those of you who are, I know that there was a bit of confusion because the last session we have wasn't recorded, but this is 5.11 of the Mahapranibbana Sutta. And the previous section is going to be missed. Maybe we can catch up on it later again at some stage just to kind of complete the whole thing here. But I think now, for now, we're just going to keep going. Otherwise, we have a kind of doubling up. And what is happening here, just to remind anyone who may be viewing this for the first time, is that the Buddha has arrived at the place where he's about to pass away, coming to the very, very end of the Buddha's life. He's lying between the famous twin sal trees, sal trees being a famous tree of this part of the world, the north of India. And he's lying there, and he's basically about to die. And now the final kind of things are being arranged and organized. The final goodbyes are being said. Buddha giving his final instructions to the Sangha. And so it's kind of a very poignant, very kind of time where everyone is kind of emotionally overwrought and things aren't really happening. It's a very interesting time for the Buddhist community, of course. So, just before where we are now, the Venerable Ananda has asked the Buddha, what shall we do with the Buddha's remains? That's in 5.10. And the Buddha has said, don't worry about the Buddha's funeral arrangements and remains, because there are lay people, basically Kattiyas, Brahmins and householders who are wise and devoted to the Buddha, and they will take care of the funeral arrangements. And then the Buddha says, the Venerable Ananda says again, but Lord, what shall we do with the Tathagata's remains? The translation here is a little bit misleading, because the first question literally asks, what shall we do? And the next one really asks, what shall be done with the Tathagata's remains? So in the first one, because it says we, he says that the monks should not be concerned about the funeral arrangements. But the second one is a general question, what is to be done? And of course it is to be expected that the monastics, they will be advisors to the lay people. That's usually how things work. Yeah, so they will advise them on what to do with the Buddha's remains. So for that reason, Venerable Ananda needs to know what to do. And this, so there's a slight variation in phrasing there, which has not doesn't come out in Maurice Walsh's translation. So sometimes you have to translate carefully to make sure you get all the details out. I might as well read from Ajahn Sujato's translation, because he has got that right, and you should be able to follow roughly on Maurice Walsh's translation in any case, because it's so close, obviously, here. So, Venerable Ananda asks, but sir, how to proceed when it comes to the realized one's corpse? Proceed in the same way as they do for the corpse of a wheel-turning monarch. But how do they proceed with a wheel-turning monarch's corpse? So here the idea is that the Buddha's body should be dealt with in the same way as a wheel-turning monarch. Of course, the wheel-turning monarch is this legendary mythological king who never really existed, had existed in India before. It seems to be taken out of some of the mythology and legends found in the Vedic texts of India, and somehow based upon that. So the idea here is that the wheel-turning monarch, being the kind of great legendary mythological creature who rules the entire India, this is kind of at the height of what is possible in terms of worldly power. Yeah, it doesn't go any higher than that. In the Suttas, the wheel-turning monarch is the absolute supremacy and wealth and power and being beloved by all the disciples and the people in the country and all of that. So here the Buddha, of course, is compared to that, which is what you would expect. Yeah, the Buddha is compared to the highest, and that is kind of, I think, the point of this passage, to compare the Buddha to the highest. And then to say, it doesn't say in this sutta, but in one of the parallel versions of the Mahapranibbana Sutta, it says that the Buddha should be treated in the same way, and then even more. In this one, it just says the same way. So this is what is going on here. This is why the wheel-turning monarch comes in, even though the wheel-turning monarch really is just a legendary person. So the Buddha has to explain, yeah, what that means. When the Buddha, you know, I guess he can say pretty much whatever he wants at this point, because nobody knows anything about the wheel-turning monarch. So he can make it up as he goes along, presumably. I guess, I don't know, maybe he had some memory of a past life of a wheel-turning monarch. Who knows? But it might very well be that he just kind of comes up with what seems appropriate. And this is what is appropriate. They wrap a wheel-turning monarch's corpse with unworn cloth, then with uncarded cotton, then again with unworn cloth. It's slightly different from Horace Walsh's translation, but similar in intent. In this way, they wrap the corpse with 500 double layers. I don't know how big the Buddha was, like this wide, maybe, and after 500 layers, it would have been pretty expanded out quite a lot, presumably. It's a lot. 500 layers is a lot of cloth. Anyway, then they place it in an iron case filled with oil, close it up with another case. Then, having built a funeral pyre out of all kinds of fragrant substances, they cremate the corpse. So this is how you deal with the wheel-turning monarch, and then the Buddha's body is to be dealt with in the same way. And somebody has pointed out that the reason why it is done in this way is the idea of the uncarded cotton. The idea of that is that it soaks up oil really well, whereas the cloth may not soak up the oil. So you use uncarded raw cotton, basically, and you use that so it soaks up the oil, so the body burns really well inside the casket. That was, I'm not sure whether that's true, but that seems like a reasonable explanation. Otherwise, it's a little bit difficult to make sense of what is going on here. And then you make a funeral pyre of fragrant things, and of course, then you cremate the corpse. And this is the idea. This is where the tradition in Buddhism of cremating corpses comes from. It comes basically from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and the Buddha's corpse was cremated, so that becomes like the default position of Buddhists around the world. If the Buddha was cremated, well, we should follow the Buddha. And maybe because the Buddha attained Parinibbana, maybe if we cremate our body, the same will happen to us. Maybe not. Maybe need something additional. But maybe, you know, sometimes you think that if you follow in the footsteps of a teacher in the right way, then maybe the same thing will happen to you. Yeah, out of luck or whatever. Anyway, that might be asking for a bit too much. But the interesting thing is that the tradition of of burning corpses and cremating actually belongs to the Brahmanical tradition in India. It is something that existed prior to Buddhism. So the Buddhists really just took that on board as part of the standard way of doing things. And the Brahmanical tradition, apparently the reason why they burned the corpses, the idea apparently is that when you burn the corpse, yeah, the smoke goes up. And when the smoke rises up, it kind of goes to heaven. Whether it was meant symbolically or whether it's meant literally, I'm not sure, but this is kind of the idea. Yeah, the smoke goes up, and it kind of goes to heaven, and then you get kind of reborn in heaven on that basis. And then the Buddhists presumably just took on that tradition. So that is where the funeral tradition comes from. And if you go to places like Thailand, you go to Wat Nanachat, which was the monastery that Ajahn Brahm started in Thailand. In Wat Nanachat, they would have this kind of funeral ceremonies. Yeah, they had a place in the monastery. They made a funeral pyre, big stack of logs, and then the old grandfather or whoever who had just passed away in the village, he was put on top of the big stack of logs. And then they would light the stack, and then the whole thing would burn. Pretty amazing, isn't it? Imagine that happening here. And what they say is that it's very strange, because when that happens, they say it's really weird, because it's almost like going to barbecue, they say here. Yeah, because it smells a bit like burnt meat. It must be very strange, yeah? Going to one of these things. And then it burns really, really well, because human bodies have quite a bit of fat in them. Yeah, so it burns really hot and burns really well. And it's a very strange thing to see a human body burn like that. But it's very, so that one of the reasons why they had it in the monastery, of course, was because for the monks to be able to see lots of corpses and reminder of death and all of these things. And so they would have it in the monastery ground. And of course, the people in Thailand were very afraid of ghosts. And this is one of the things that you find in many of the Southeastern nations, is this, you've been told the ghost stories since you were tiny. Yeah, 2 years old, you start hearing your first ghost stories. And by the time you are in your teens, you are deadly afraid of ghosts because you heard so many ghost stories. So give it to the monks in the monastery. Get the corpses a bit out of the way so the ghosts kind of also stay away a little bit. I think that's part of the kind of the idea there. So it's kind of nice, yeah, as a monk you take that duty, and it's kind of useful anyway as a body contemplation for the monastics. So this is what happened to the Buddha, and this is one of those things that always is so interesting about the suttas, is that so many of the things that we take for granted now in Buddhist customs and Buddhist culture, it actually has its roots in the suttas, and this is one of those things that you find. Anyway, by the way, the number 500 there is a kind of standard number that is used in the suttas. It doesn't mean literally 500 double layers. It just means a lot of layers of cloth. That's what it means. 500 is a standard number used throughout the suttas. It just means a lot. Having cremated the corpse, they built a monument for the wheel-turning monarch at the crossroads. Yeah, the Maurice Walsh here has a stupa, and that's translated as a monument, which I think is quite nice. The word stupa is probably still fairly obscure in the English language, even though it is found in the OED. It is not a very common word. So you build a monument, and you will notice that this stupa is built at the crossroads. And of course, the reason for that is to give easy access to these monuments. If someone who has died and has a monument built for them, the purpose of the monument is obviously for people to visit it. So it should be at an easy and accessible place. And the crossroads, where everyone comes from all directions, is easily accessible. You can stop your chariot, you can kind of get off, and you can, you know, put some flowers or incense or bow down to the monument or whatever, and you can kind of carry on afterwards. And that is how the Buddha's remains are also supposed to be looked after. So that's how they proceed with the wheel-turning monarch's corpse. Proceed in the same way with the realized one's corpse. A monument for the realized one is to be built at the crossroads. So the interesting word here, of course, is the word stupa. The word stupa is tupa in Pali, stupa in Sanskrit. This is the only place in the suttas where this word occurs. Actually, it's not the only place. There's one other place where it occurs, it's a rather surprising place. It is found in the Vinaya Pitaka. And in the Vinaya Pitaka, there's a rule for the monks which says, Natupato omaditva pindavata angundisamiti sikakaraniya. Tupato means from a stupa. You should not eat from a stupa. And that gives you the idea of the origin of this word, because eating from a stupa here means a heap. Yes, you have a heap in your bowl, like a heap of rice or whatever. You're not supposed to eat from a heap. You're supposed to even out the food in your bowl before you eat it, so that you have a kind of take evenly from what is available in the bowl. So that is the original meaning of the word stupa. It's like a heap. Yeah, this is where it comes from. And a very humble heap at that, a heap of rice in your bowl. So this is what it originally meant, and it would have been fairly humble in the early days. The early stupas would have been maybe just a mound of earth or something like that, and maybe would have some kind of decoration on it, presumably to mark that here someone had passed away, something very simple, but it was very unelaborate in the early days. And there is very little references to stupas anywhere prior to their use found here in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So really, the stupa is almost like a Buddhist monument that started with a Buddhist. There has been some speculation where the stupas come from. Almost all the stupas that exist in the world are found in connection with Buddhism. There's one or two exceptions. That is a stupa done for the Jains or the Jains, very ascetic sect in India. There's, I think, one or two stupas for them. And that has led people to believe that stupas belonged to the Samana tradition. Yeah, the Samanas are the ascetics of ancient India. In ancient India, you had the Brahmins, who were the kind of the priestly caste of India, and then you had the ascetics who went out of Indian society altogether, lived in the forest, lived in the wilderness. And this is the Samana tradition. And the Samana tradition consists of a large number of different religions, or different sects and sects basically, different religions. And they all have their own teachings and their own followings and all of that. And it seems that the stupas may have originated from that Samana movement. Yeah, they would take their leaders, their saints, whoever they regarded as their saints, and they would put them into stupas to worship. But the reality is that it is almost, that may be the case, but the reality is that the stupa really has become a Buddhist monument. Yeah, because it is in Buddhism that we found these things around the world and doesn't really exist anywhere else. So this can be said to be the Buddhist contribution to world architecture. So if you have anyone ever ask you what Buddhism has done for the world, we invented the stupa. You can tell them that. Is that good? Yeah. Well, it's at least something visible. Yeah, everything else is inside. Kind of one thing visible that we have done. And there are some pretty impressive stupas around the world. If you go around the world, some really, really impressive ones. And just to give you some ideas, that first of all, maybe a little bit about the history of the stupa. It started off with little mounds, and then gradually they expanded. You got, you know, once the brick making started in India, maybe a century after the Buddha, the time of the Buddha, there was almost no brick making. Everything was done out of clay and earth, and that's why there are so few remains in India from the time of the Buddha. This is one of those astonishing things. If you look at the archaeology of ancient India, there's hardly anything left at all prior to the time of Ashoka. Ashoka was about 100, 150 years after the Buddha. That's when really the archaeological excavations, they begin at that time. Actually, they begin before that, because there's also the Indus Valley civilization, but the Indus Valley civilization was far away from the Ganges, and it's a long time before. But there's a long gap there in the archaeological record between the Indus Valley civilization and the Ganges Valley civilization, which started around Ashoka. And in that period, there was no stones or bricks or any kind of unperishable semi-unperishable substances were not really used in building. And for that reason, there's hardly any archaeological record for that whole long period, over 1,000 years, between the Indus Valley and the Ganges Valley civilizations. So what that means is that the stupas originally just being built out of earth, yeah, and then gradually when the bricks were starting to be made after the Buddha, they started to use bricks, and they became larger very, very quickly. And some of the earliest very famous stupas in India is like the Bharut stupa, which is found in the Ganges Plain. Another very famous stupa in India is the Sanchi stupas, which you can go and visit today. They are World Heritage Sites, very, very beautiful stupas. I would recommend you to Google them and look at some of the pictures of the Sanchi stupas, S-A-N-C-H-I. You can look it straight up on Google. Very, very beautiful, exquisite carvings, yeah, with gates, and you can see the Jataka stories in the carvings, the elephants and the kind of the Bodhisattva and all of that. And if you like artwork and you want a bit of Dhamma in your artwork, then that is kind of a nice mix of worldly and spiritual things mixed together, spiritual artwork. Very beautiful. This is the Sanchi, very famous Sanchi stupas. And sometimes it's fascinating how they find stupas in India. They just take a photograph from some satellite or something, and they look for little bumps in the terrain. Yeah, there's a stupa over there, there's a stupa here, there's something missing in the middle, there should be another stupa over there, so let's look there. They see a bump in the terrain, and they start digging, and lo and behold, they find another stupa. That's how we discover stupas sometimes. It's kind of interesting. And then they dig it out, and of course, there's some very interesting remains sometimes that have been found in that particular way, by just digging where the ground has been elevated. There's a stupa called the Deokotar stupa in the Ganges plain, which was discovered only about 20, 30 years ago, and it had some very interesting inscriptions of student-teacher lineages going all the way from the time of the Buddha all the way to the time when that stupa was made. It's interesting, yeah? Suddenly you have an archaeological excavation that connects that particular archaeological thing you have discovered to the Buddha. directly through a teacher-student relationships all the way back to the time of the Buddha. Actually, not back to the time of the Buddha, back to Anuruddha, or back to one of the Buddha's chief disciples, that's more correct to say here. But very interesting, this is kind of some of the very only archaeological findings that we have that actually connect us directly to the Buddha historically. That's the famous Deokotar. Actually, not famous at all, actually. I'm not sure why I'm saying famous, because I guess for me it feels famous, but it is the Deokotar Stupa, and you can look that up as well on Wikipedia. It should be there. A very recent discovery in the Ganges Plain there. And then, of course, the stupas then, having lots of stupas in India, then they went out of India and they started building stupas in places like the northwest of India, in Gandhara especially, and there the stupas started to transform and they became very different. And in Gandhara the stupas became elongated, like more like towers. Yeah, very long spires. And of course, eventually, that particular design of stupa that you find in there in Gandhara, that is the same kind of stupas that were gradually exported to China. Yeah, because Gandhara was the closest part of India to China. The Silk Road was very close to there. And with the Silk Road, the Buddhist monks and Buddhist other people, they would go to China. And then they would introduce Buddhism to China. And that is how you got stupas in China. But in China, they're called pagodas. Yeah, and I'm sure you have seen the pictures of pagodas in China. It doesn't look anything like a stupa at all. It looks like this multi-layered tower with many, many layers. But actually, originally, it is actually a stupa. That's the original design that it comes from. So when you see an East Asian pagoda, you have them in China, in Korea, in Japan, all those places. It is also derived from the stupa originally. And the word pagoda, quite possibly, is in turn derived from the Sinhala word dagaba or dagoba. And the word dagoba is a word used in Sri Lanka for stupa. And the word dagoba in Sri Lanka means, it's a contraction of the words datu garba. Yeah, datu is a relic, is a word for relic in Pali. Datu in the suttas means element, but in the later Buddhist text, the word datu comes to mean a relic, like an element of the Buddha, if you like. So if you ever see a Buddha relic, and sometimes you see Buddha relics on little kind of little white things, yeah, and these are called datus. And garba means chamber or room, so it's a chamber for the Buddha relics. That's where the word dagoba comes from. And then they get somehow transposed, so it becomes called the pagoda in East Asia. So all of these things are related. Yeah, all these words are very closely related to each other. And some of the most amazing stupas in the world are found in Sri Lanka. They have some of the most magnificent stupas. I've seen them myself with my own eyes, and it's hard to believe when you see them. These enormous things, over 100 meters tall, and they were even taller before the tops of them kind of collapsed and fell down. They are supposed to be the largest brick-made structures in the ancient world prior to modern times, larger than anything else anywhere else, the stupas on Sri Lanka. I wonder how many. I think the ancient Sri Lankans were probably, think they were happy to build those stupas, and probably. Such enormous things. Sri Lanka is a fairly small island. Population would have been fairly small. They probably had half the population building stupas at that time, I can imagine. And the rest of the half feeding them or something like that. Really, would have been pretty interesting. So these are the stupas around the world. And of course, you have the Shwedagon stupa in Burma, remember, one of the most famous stupas in the world. So stupas have become a very important aspect of Buddhism and almost a symbol of Buddhism in many ways. For that reason, they are kind of interesting to know a little bit about the history of these things. There is another word as well which is related to all of these things. That's the word chaitya or chaitya, which means something like a shrine. And that word is also these days it is used almost synonymously with a stupa, but that word actually means something like a shrine, a forest shrine. And it seems to have existed in India prior to Buddhism. And it would be a place where people would go to, maybe to do an offering to their ancestors or to the gods or something like that. And a kind of standard shrine that you see in the present day also in many Buddhist houses and families and throughout Asia. You see these kind of shrines. It's a slightly different thing from a stupa. It's more a general shrine. It could mean anything almost. Anyway, so that is a little bit about stupas and how they have kind of transformed and changed, and how important they are for Buddhism. If you go to a place like Burma, there's stupas everywhere, and there's this idea that to build a stupa is very meritorious. There is no mention of that anywhere in the suttas. This is a later idea. Don't shoot where it comes from. And I have my doubts. It's a nice thing to do, but how meritorious it is, I think it's better to support the Sangha in a way which is kind of helpful for Buddhism. That's what I think is better, personally. I'm not sure if building stupas is all that useful, especially when you already have a few thousands and you build, 2001. It's not going to kind of add that much to the landscape. If you go to Burma Pagan, it's like every hilltop has a stupa, and then you build one more. You won't even see that stupa because there's so many already. It's kind of I think that is another place where we have to be perhaps a little bit more circumspect about what it means to make merit. Making merit is about sustaining Buddhism, doing something of kindness, doing something which supports somebody, helps something out. And there's a very clear limit to how much you help anything out by building stupas. Anyway, so let us carry on. Comes another interesting little passage here. It says that when someone there, in other words at the stupa, lifts up garlands or fragrance or powder or bows or inspires confidence in their heart, that will be for their lasting welfare and happiness. And we'll see in a second what that means, because it becomes a little bit more explained further down. But the idea here is that when you have confidence in your heart, when you have a sense of faith, that usually what comes with that is joy and happiness. Yeah, this is kind of the idea. It's a recollection of the Buddha, if you like. This is what this is really really about here. And of course, that confidence and joy, if it is done in the right way, will always lead to something very positive as a consequence. And this is really the purpose of the stupa. And here the purpose is given. Yeah, it's not just to build the stupa, but it is a commemoration of someone who has passed away, someone who is important, and the idea is to give rise to joy. That is the purpose. These things should always have a purpose. This shouldn't be like just a magic thing that you do and suddenly lots of good stuff comes out of the magic. That's not how Buddhism works. There should be a clear causal relationship between things. So you do this, you build a stupa, and you bow down, you think, wow, the Buddha was here. I don't know if you had that feeling when you go to India. I know many of you have been to India. And many people, when they go to India, they can feel some very powerful emotions when they go to these places. Some people don't, some people do. It varies a bit. But if you kind of get into that feeling that you're walking in the footsteps of the Buddha and you have a sense of the Buddha, it can be very powerful and very strong. And that is kind of what this is about. Yeah, it should have a very clear purpose, not just building stupas randomly. Anyway, let's have a little bit more about what this is about, because this comes next here. Ananda, these four are worthy of a monument. What four? A realized one, a perfected one, a fully awakened, sorry, this is the same person, a realized one, a perfected one, a fully awakened Buddha, a Buddha awakened for themselves, a disciple of a realized one, and a wheel-turning monarch. So first of all, you have the Buddha, then you have the Pacheka Buddha, yeah, they awaken for themselves, someone who is just a private Buddha, whatever you want to call them, they don't teach. Then you have the disciple of the Buddha, which means the noble ones, the Aryans. Yeah, so any Aryan we should have a stupa for as well. And last, Chakravarti Dhammaraja, the wheel-turning monarch that we saw before. These are the four, and this is the sequence of importance, I suppose, of those four people. And for what reason is a realized one worthy of a monument? So that many people would inspire confidence in their hearts, thinking, this is the monument of that blessed one, perfected and fully awakened. And having done so, when their body breaks up after death, they are reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. It is for this reason that the realized one is worthy of a monument. So, interesting passage. Again, this is what I met before, the idea of what it means to, for something to be for the long-lasting benefit and happiness of someone when they inspire confidence in their heart based on the stupa, based on someone being someone's remains being there. That's what it means. Long-lasting happiness and benefit means you get reborn in a good destination afterwards. Yeah, so that joy, that happiness that you have at that time is the exact opposite of the defilements of the mind that might lead you to a bad destination. So if you have that joy when you, as you die, and maybe take that into the dying process and into the intermediate stages or whatever, and that will carry you on to a good destination afterwards. Because at that point, you have a very pure mind. The spiritual joy is opposed to the impurities of the mind. When you have spiritual joy, you don't have the impurities of the mind. I'm sure you know what I mean. Yeah, sometimes you feel joyful, you do something nice, whether it's meditation practice, something else. You know that mind state you have, when you feel real joy in that sense, is opposed to, it's just obvious when you feel it, that it's opposed to the defilements and the worldly kind of states of mind that you might otherwise have. It's sort of very clear when you feel these things. And this is kind of interesting, because I remember, this is kind of also ties in a little bit with Christianity, this idea that in Christianity that you have, if you have faith, yeah, all you need is faith to be kind of, to be reborn with God or whatever it is. I'm not sure, I don't know much about Christianity, but something like that. Yeah, if you kind of have faith, then you kind of go to heaven or something afterwards. And I always thought these things were kind of rubbish. Yeah. When I grew up, I was very kind of skeptical about Christianity. I thought it was all a lot of nonsense and I wasn't really very impressed with it. But then when you read passages like this, it forces you to reconsider a little bit. Maybe they had a point. Yeah, could the Christians be right? After all, that if you have faith, then you get reborn in heaven. This is what it says here. Almost exactly what it says. Yeah, if you have faith, then you get reborn in heaven. And it's interesting, when you get things explained from a point of view where you can understand it, because you are used to Buddhist ideas, suddenly what before you thought was rubbish actually turns out maybe to have a point to it. So the Christians, presumably, is exactly the same thing. You have faith in God or whatever it is, and if that faith is a good kind of faith, and you have it's pure and it's joyous perhaps because of your joy, then you are likely to be reborn in heaven. Yeah. So you go to the Christian section of heaven. The Buddhists go to the Buddhist section of heaven. Yeah, the good Buddhists. The Muslims go to the Muslim section of heaven. The atheists go to the atheist section of heaven. So it is just actually somebody said that. It's not just a joke. Apparently somebody said that. Someone is supposed to have the divine eye. They said that in heaven, they have these sections. Yeah, if you're Buddhists, you go there. Christians go there. So there might be something to that. But the idea here is this idea that if you have faith and confidence and you have purity inside, that will naturally lead you to a good destination in the future. And it kind of makes you reconsider things that you thought were nonsensical. Suddenly, they look in a different light when you see them from a Buddhist point of view. So it's strange. So maybe I was too quick in discarding Christianity. Maybe it was a mistake. What do you think? No, I don't think so. I don't think there's any way back to Christianity for me. That boat is gone. It's gone a long time ago. Anyway, so that is the purpose of this, yeah? And this is what is the point of the stupa. This is the point, we looked at this before also, of going around to the holy places in Buddhism, the four holy places, a similar kind of thing, yeah? The idea of giving rise to this inspiration and confidence and joy and all these kind of things. And then the Buddha continues, and for what reason is a Buddha awakened for themselves worthy of a monument? This is the Pacheka Buddha. So many people will inspire confidence in their hearts, thinking this is the monument for that Buddha awakened for himself. And having done so, when their body breaks up after death, they are reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. It is for this reason that the Buddha awakened for himself is worthy of a monument. So even the Pacheka Buddha, similar kind of idea, yeah? If you see a Pacheka Buddha, they don't even teach, and still you gain this confidence. And this has to do, of course, with the fact that just seeing an arahant in the world, seeing somebody who has a conduct that is so different, will awaken something inside of you. The feeling that something else is possible, the feeling that there are higher states. All they had to do is to see something external to understand that there's something going on inside that is really special. And for what reason is it realized one's disciple worthy of a monument, of a stupa? So many people will inspire confidence in their hearts thinking, this is the monument for that blessed one's disciple. And having done so, when the body breaks up after death, they are reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. It is for this reason that a realized one's disciple is worthy of a monument. And for what reason is a wheel-turning monarch worthy of a monument? Actually, before I go on to that, a blessed one's disciple, so these are the Aryas. If there is an Arya, we should make a stupa for them. What does that mean in practice? Does that mean that we have to make a stupa for Ajahn Brahm when he dies? Is that what it means? What do you think? Maybe that's what it means. It might mean that. So we have to kind of have the... So you remember, the monks are not going to be involved. So that's up to the lay people. So you have to kind of do this. I'm kind of warning you now. You have to build a stupa when I'm getting ready for this. But it might be the case. And then in a sense, that would be very nice if you had a stupa. And I don't know what you think, but if you have a stupa and people have this feeling that there's a saint buried there, the remains of a saint are actually there, it would be kind of powerful, wouldn't it, in the future? It would be this feeling that Australia is really on the map when it comes to Buddhism, when it comes to real Buddhism, in a sense, when you have kind of the stupa there as well. Even just now, the idea of that is kind of nice. It's beautiful. It reminds you of what real Buddhism is about and what really matters in the Buddhist teachings and all of that. So maybe that is something to consider, especially, as I think it's probably too early to discount Ajahn Brahm already. We have to give him maybe a few more years, but down the track. Okay. And for what reason is a wheel-turning monarch worthy of a monument? So that many people will inspire confidence in their hearts, thinking, this is the monument for that just and principled king. And having done so, when the body breaks up after death, they are reborn in a good place, a heavenly realm. It is for this reason that a wheel-turning monarch is worthy of a monument. These four are worthy of a monument. So, there you are. So that was very brief in Maurice Walsh's translation, quite a bit longer in Ajahn Sujato's translation. So that is the chapter on stupas, and that is all there is about stupas in the entire Pali, the four Nikayas. There you are. Now you know everything there is to know about stupas from the point of view of early Buddhism. Now we can move on to the next section. Then Venerable Ananda entered a dwelling and stood leaning against a door jamb and crying, I'm still only a trainee with work left to do, and my teacher is about to become fully extinguished, he who is so kind to me. Okay, let's just maybe stop there for just a minute. First thing here, he leaning against a door jamb, which is a little bit strange because it's supposed to be in a sal grove. There's no mention so far of any buildings or anything. And in fact, in one of the parallel versions of the sutta, it doesn't say anything about door jamb. It says that the Ananda is leaning on the bed that the Buddha is lying on. That might be more reliable, perhaps. And this is just to remind us again that some of these details have sometimes been written by people who were not necessarily present, or they didn't know what was going on. And these were laid down maybe a few years. This story may have been written a few years after the Buddha, when these suttas were put together and they were kind of made ready for inclusion in the Nikayas and that sort of thing. But it might be that the Pali here it might not be quite right, because it doesn't really seem to be any door jamb. Kind of this requires a dwelling, and there's no mention of dwelling so far. But perhaps there was a dwelling there. Who knows exactly what was going on? Anyway, Venerable Ananda is crying, and he is thinking, the Buddha is about to pass away. I'm only a trainee, not an arahant yet. And so what's going to happen to me after the Buddha has passed away? That's pretty much what he's saying here. So this is a kind of interesting, because you might have thought that someone who was a trainee, remember a trainee means an Aryan. It does not mean one who has gone beyond training is the Arahant, and someone in training is the noble ones before they become Arahants. And if you're not a noble one, you're not even in training yet. Yeah, you're kind of desperately trying to get into training here. So that's kind of the problem. If you're not a noble one, then you are, you know, not even training here. It's kind of and the reason you're not training is because you don't really know what the path is. You're kind of fumbling around. That's what it's called. Fumbling around is a technical term before you become in training. Actually, fumbling around is not really a technical term, right? It's just but that's kind of the term. because you are trying to find your way, yeah? You're finding your way through, and eventually, when you find the path, you become a stream entry, then you are properly in training, because you know what the path is. That's kind of the point of these words. So there's the seka, the one who's in training, the aseka, the one beyond training, yeah? These are the two things. But interesting how even a stream entry can become so distraught, yeah? Because of attachment to the Buddha, and it shows you some of the power of that, this kind of moment in Buddhist history when the Buddha is about to pass away. And I think a lot of attachment that was pointed out by someone recently, a lot of the idea of attachment in human beings is the habits that we have. When we have certain habits, we tend to be attached to those habits. And Venerable Ananda has just been hanging around the Buddha for over 20 years. Yeah, imagine being so close. Here you have this enormous, towering spiritual figure. And then he's about to pass away. And you have been relying on everything for this person and everything. And you have been around him all the time and kind of felt that, got into that habit of being around him. And now suddenly he's about to go. And you don't really know what life is going to be without him anymore. So even for a stream mentor, even though you know the Dhamma, even though you know everything is impermanent, even though you know that the refuge really is inside, like we saw before, in meditation, in insight, in all of that, even though you know all of those things, still your mind is so overwhelmed at this particular powerful moment of history. Yeah, it's this distinction again in the suttas between views, thoughts and perceptions. And even though your view is right, your thinking and your perceptions are not yet fully corrected. So here he's kind of allowing himself to be led astray a little bit. Interesting how this is true, even for the stream entry. Or maybe he's not the stream entry. Maybe this is an indication that he's not a stream entry. I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know how. I haven't really looked it up, how strong the evidence in the suttas that Venerable Ananda is a stream entry. I don't think it's very strong. There's a couple of passages, one of them being this one, where he thinks, oh, I'm a seka. But that's just the part of the narrative. It's not a very strong kind of evidence. It's not the Buddha saying, you are a stream entry or anything like that. So maybe that's also an open possibility. I'm just kind of opening up some possibilities here, even though that is quite a probably radical difference from usual. Yes, we're talking. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So if we take that literally, Sorry? Yeah, exactly. So, and then he said, everyone, the least monk among these 500 is a stream entry. So he said, all the old streamers. If you take that literally, you're right. And then it means that the old stream entry is there. Yeah, so there are a few indications like that. But I wouldn't call any of them, I don't think they are very strong kind of evidence, because remember that this really, a lot of this here is narrative, yeah, and this also is narrative, and there is a lot of discrepancies in this narrative between the various suttas. I haven't looked at that particular part of it, but I will when we get there eventually, because it's just down the line. So I don't know. It's just something I'm throwing out there. I don't know what the answer is. I haven't really looked it up, but sometimes it might be useful to kind of, you know, sometimes need to look at these things in more detail sometimes. Yeah. 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 There is, again, there is some disagreement of Lady Visakha, whether she was a stream enter or whether she was kind of on the path to stream entry, what she was. There's some disagreement on that. It's pretty good. Yeah. But again, the evidence is also still very weak, you know. For all of these things, it's very weak evidence. It's very rare that someone is specifically said. One of the ones that is kind of strongest one is maybe the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where the Buddha specifically says that, Kondanya has understood, Anyasi Vatabo Kondanyo. He specifically says that he has understood, indicating that he is a stream enterer. But it may very well be that he's a stream enterer. I'm not saying that he's not. I'm taking that as the default position. I'm just kind of saying, who knows? Yeah, I'm just kind of opening up possibilities here. Yeah. Until proven otherwise, we should absolutely assume that he's a stream entry. I think it makes sense. Anyway, then the Buddha said to the mendicants, "Mendicants, where is Ananda? Sir, Ananda has entered a dwelling and stands there leaning against the door jamb and crying, I'm still only a trainee with work left to do, and my teacher is about to become fully extinguished, he who is so kind to me." So the Buddha said to a certain monk, "Please, monk, in my name, tell Ananda that the teacher summons him." "Yes, sir," that monk replied. He went to Ananda and said to him, "Reverend Ananda, the teacher summons you." "Yes, Reverend," Ananda replied. He went to the Buddha, bowed, sat down to one side, and the Buddha said to him, "Enough, Ananda, do not grieve, do not lament. Did I not prepare for this when I explained that we must be parted and separated from all we hold dear and beloved? How could it possibly be so that what is born, created, conditioned, and liable to fall apart should not fall apart, even the realized one's body?" So here is this refrain that we are kind of seeing throughout the Mahaparinibbana Sutta again and again. And this particular thing has been said earlier on. This is a very famous saying by the Buddha, and it's also found in the suttas elsewhere as one of the five reflections that we should do all the time. Yeah, to remember that everything that is dear and agreeable to us will become separated from us and will become otherwise. And here, this is what you see throughout the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. There's a great emphasis on impermanence. It's one of the themes that kind of goes throughout the sutta. Because obviously, this is a very powerful time of impermanence, of unreliability, of things being out of control for the Buddhist community. And here, he's again laying this down and telling Ananda, "But you know, I've been telling you about this." So it is hard to take this on board fully, even if you are a stream entry. So he would assume he was a stream entry, we're talking for this for now. Even if you're a stream entry, it is hard to take this on board fully, and you often lose it a little bit when the things become too difficult and too hard. And you may remember from earlier on, we've been doing the sutta for a long time now, but if you have a really, really good memory, you might remember this, that the Buddha says, actually, you should find instead the refuge should instead be in the meditation. It should be an island unto yourself. Yeah, should be your own refuge. Take the Dhamma as your refuge. And the way to do that is to practice meditation, to practice the Satipatthana practices, the mindfulness of breathing and all that. That is where you are a refuge. Why? Because when you draw within yourself, when you let go of the external world, you let go of the five senses, you just go inside of yourself, that is precisely where you are free of the disturbances of the outside world. And whatever happens in the outside world is no longer able to touch you. So this is obviously, that is why that is the place of refuge. And you use that to kind of to safeguard you from all the external problems. So the Buddha is telling him again, so very important idea throughout the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and again, something that everyone should reflect on. The Buddha specifically said that this reflection is for everyone. It is for lay people and monastics, for men and women. Yeah, he kind of makes it very clear everyone is included in this. That is kind of nice to recall. It's actually a very powerful reflection. If you really get this reflection fully, then you understand why the spiritual path is where the refuge is, and the world is just so incredibly unreliable. The whole five sense world is really out of control. Simple reflection like that can take you a really long way on the path, certainly all the way to the jhanas, just by that kind of reflection, if you do it thoroughly and consistently. How could it possibly be that whatever has arisen, born, created, conditioned, could not fall apart? And that, of course, includes the body of the Buddha. Let's see what the Pali is there. Tathagatasa sarirang, which is the body of the Buddha. For a long time, Ananda, you have treated the realized one with deeds of body, speech, and mind that are loving, beneficial, pleasant, wholehearted, and limitless. You have done good deeds, Ananda. Devote yourself to meditation, and you will soon be free of defilements. Here the Buddha is reminding Ananda of all the good karma that he has made, basically. Kata punyosi, Ananda, you have made merit, Ananda. And is reminding him of that, and of course reminding him that this is the foundation for meditation practice and for insight down the track. So that actually that is how you become free of the corruptions. Again, he's just reminding Ananda that he is ready, he has kind of prepared the ground, and also reminding all of us that this actually is where the practice really is at so often. If you want the meditation to work, this is what you have to do. You have to have those acts by body, speech, and mind of metta. The word metta is specifically used here. And that, if you can do that consistently, then the meditation will just tend to happen by itself. This is, of course, part of this idea of recollection of our good actions. The sila nusati, the chaga nusati. This is what this is about. And here the Buddha is kind of just helping that to happen. So it shows you, again, that it's useful sometimes to help each other, to remind each other of the good things in our lives. It is so easy to forget about the good things. If you've been keeping the five precepts for a long time, if you've been supporting charitable causes for many years, I know many of you have been doing that. To remind each other to actually understand, actually, we're doing something really, really positive here. We're doing something to support the world, support ourselves, support everyone around us. What a wonderful thing that is. It's actually great. It's good to feel a bit of spiritual joy because of these things. So remember these good things. Too often we focus on the negative, and this is what Ananda is doing here, is focusing on the negative, really. He's focusing on the loss rather than focusing what he has gained by living with the Buddha. What he has gained is this ability to serve. That ability to serve now is going to be used for meditation practice in the future. That is actually what has will enable him eventually to become an arahant, all that service that he has been doing. And this is a very useful reminder for all of us in life when somebody passes away, when somebody dies, what the focus is on. The focus should be on what we have gained, in a sense, the positive that has happened through our association with that person, with whoever that person is. You reflect on the positive, what you have got out of it, and then you can feel a sense of joy even when someone is passing away. Thank you for being there. Thank you for being part of my life. Thank you for giving me a chance to learn from you, to help you, to whatever it is, and then it will lift you up rather than drag you down when somebody passes away in this way. It's all about perception. Perceive things in the right way. Even negative, so-called negative things can become very positive if you think about in the right way. And this is the Buddha here basically showing Venerable Ananda how to think correctly. Remember the good stuff. Have these nice little words here. All of these things are loving. The metta is the word there. Hita is beneficial. Sukha, connected with happiness. Advaya means undivided, quite literally, or not twofold. So he has translated as wholehearted, which I think is actually very good. Wholehearted, not divided. And appamana, appamanena, limitless. The limitless support and kindness that he's been using there. These are all important words in the suttas that are found in many different places. And appamana, of course, being one of the words used for the Brahma Viharas. You have the limitless Brahma Viharas of metta and karuna, etc. So, and then the Buddha says, if you devote yourself, padanang anuyunja, padana literally means effort. So if you apply effort, Adasudhatu has said here, devote yourself to meditation, but it really means effort. Of course, meditation is included. And then you will soon be free of defilement. Skippang ahisi anasavo, anasavo, without asavas. And so here, the Buddha is making what looks almost like a prediction. Yeah, that Venerable Ananda will be free of the asavas. He will become an arahant, in other words. He's almost predicting that. Or is he? It's hard to say, isn't it? It's not entirely clear whether he is actually making a prediction or he's just saying that, well, you have done the groundwork. If you meditate, this is what's going to happen. This is just natural. Yeah, it happens to everyone if they do the right thing. You become an arahant. You become an asava. So is it really a prediction? Sometimes these things are taken as predictions, but I think that is taking it perhaps too strictly, in a too limited fashion. I think it may just be the Buddha encouraging him, yeah? You've done the foundation work, now if you practice, you're going to get there. Yeah, this is just the way things are. Yeah? And one of the things that you find in the suttas is that the Buddha very rarely makes any predictions at all. This is one of the very few ones. And is this really a prediction? Well, to me, not at all clear. In fact, when you read the Sarvastivadin version of this particular sutta, there is no prediction at all. The Buddha does not say anything about Venerable Ananda becoming an arahant, an anasava later on. This is only found here in the Pali. So you wonder whether this actually really is a prediction at all. And the only other place, or one of the few places where the Buddha seems to make a prediction, is when he talks about Devadatta. And he says about Devadatta that he has done so many bad deeds, and he predicts that he will be reborn in a hell realm later on. And that whole story is also quite mythological and legendary in many ways. It's found in the Vinaya mostly. And so it's actually not a very common thing for the Buddha to make predictions about the future. Not really something that he does. And so the whole idea that the Buddha does that, and that this is a prediction, I think is perhaps a mistake, and it may not original at all. And if it is original, I think it may very well just be a cause and effect thing. Okay, you do this, you're going to become an arahant in the future. Anyway, it's just again just to bring back the idea that the Buddha, he didn't really say so many extraordinary things and do things that were really out there. And the things that, could see into the future and all this kind of stuff that we talk about later on. There's actually an interesting sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Chula Sakuludaya Sutta. I think it's Majjhima Nikaya 79, I think, where the Buddha talks about predicting the future and knowing the past, knowing the past, knowing the future. And there he says that the way to know the past is to recall your past lives. The way to know the future is to understand the laws of karma. That's how you know the future and the past. Yeah, so there's nothing very magical about it. It's just basically working with what already is known about the world and how kind of your mind carries on from one life to the next one. And just by working with that, that is the extent to which you know the future and the past. Nothing really much more than that. So that seems to be the limit, at least from that sutta, of how the Buddha looks at these things, not just general kind of predictions or anything like that. But anyway, whatever is the truth, I don't know. I just wanted to make that little point. So let us carry on a little bit more. If at any point you want to tell me off for being too skeptical, please feel free to do so. Huitong is already quite good at that, but other ones can also do that if they wish. So, or any other questions for that matter. Then the Buddha said to the mendicants, the Buddhas of the past or the future also have attendants who are no better than Ananda is for me. Ananda is astute. He's intelligent. He knows the time for monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen, kings, ministers, religious founders, and the disciples of religious founders to visit the realized one. So, this is quite a little bit strange. He's really praising Venerable Ananda here. Yeah, first of all, talking about his good deeds, how well he has lived. So he's really helping to lift Venerable Ananda up from his kind of slight depression, perhaps, of the Buddha passing away. And you can see how skillful the Buddha is in doing this here. He's really helping out one of his prime disciples. And this is one of the beautiful things that you see throughout the Mahapanibbana Sutta, how the Buddha focuses often on individual people and helps individuals who are in particularly difficult situations, like Chunda the smith, who gives the Buddha the last meal, and also other cases where he does that. So he actually cares for individuals. The Buddha is not just a universal teacher who teaches kind of, you know, in a general principle way, but he actually cares for individuals. Something you see in a number of places in the suttas, if you know the details well. And that's very beautiful. It brings out the humanity of the Buddha. It makes him more one of us again. Yeah, he has a direct interaction. And he deals with things like very much like other human beings do. And this is the same thing now. Now he's looking after Venerable Ananda and making sure that he is well. Yes, please. Right. That's what I think, because there is other versions of the sutta which basically says that nothing happened to the Buddha afterwards. Yeah, there was no illness there. So I think it is quite likely that didn't happen. But I think that regardless of what happened, I think the point is that was his last meal. Yeah. So Chunda may still have felt the sense of remorse because he was the last one who fed him and the Buddha died afterwards. So he may still have felt maybe that there was something wrong. Yeah. Maybe he was slightly at fault. Maybe the food wasn't 100%. Maybe, you know, he should have fed him something else, like, you know, something more healthy or something like that. I don't know. But it could be that he still might have felt bad despite the fact that the last meal was not poisonous. And I think that's more likely, because if the last meal was poisonous, obviously it would have been terrible for him. It would have felt really, really bad, inconsolable probably. He killed the greatest spiritual master in human history. Imagine doing that. It would feel pretty bad when that happens. So that would have been almost impossible to rectify afterwards. But I think it's more natural to understand it as he just fed him ordinary food, but he still needed to be consoled that he hadn't done anything wrong here. Yeah, that is kind of my understanding of this.
So, but he was on his deathbed, very weak.
At what point? Now? Yeah. Yeah, it's good, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. It's very nice. Yeah, it's very kind of beautiful. And this is what I like about these little things, you know. They're very kind of human and very kind of, very powerful. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So now he's praising Venerable Ananda, and he's saying that he's astute and intelligent, and the words for that is pandita. Pandita is a word that is used in the suttas generally to mean someone who has insight and understanding. And then he says this thing about, and then he explains what he means by that. And what he means is that he knows the right time for people to visit the Buddha. It's kind of a little bit strange, isn't it? I don't know exactly how to understand that. You know, this is Venerable Ananda, supposed to be a noble one. It's supposed to have insight into the Dhamma. And the Buddha praises him by saying that he knows the right time for people to visit him. Sure, you know, it makes some degree of sense, because knowing the right time obviously is very important, because the Buddha doesn't want to be bothered at the wrong time. He gets his meditation and he has to rest at the right time and all of that. But it still seems like kind of a very kind of ordinary thing to say. Yeah, and maybe for that reason, maybe it's true, maybe it's real. Because these other things, these little strange things like that seem very ordinary, that seem very kind of things you wouldn't really expect to be made up. Nobody would make that up about Venerable Ananda, that he's really wise. Because why? Well, because he knows the right time for people to visit the Buddha. People have said, yeah, because he was a stream enter, or because he knew all the suttas, yeah. These are the really amazing qualities about Ananda in later tradition. But the Buddha, according to the Buddha, the most amazing thing is that he knows the right time for people to visit him. Interesting, yeah. Fascinating. And for this reason, I think it's quite likely to be real. Nobody would invent a story like that. And these are the things that actually make the suttas, to my mind, so authentic. These are not things that have been made up afterwards, that a committee came together and kind of hammered it out. Yeah, this is what the Buddha said, and you know, Ananda said that, and kind of we're going to hammer it out. Because committees will never come up with this kind of stuff. Committees will come up with something much more square, that fits the box, that is accepted by everyone. Committees have to compromise. They can't come up with weird things. But the suttas are full of these weird little things, little idiosyncrasies that you would never expect to be there. Yeah, which kind of don't make any sense at all, except if it is an ordinary life, because ordinary life is full of weird little stuff that happens and nobody can really understand it afterwards. There was just recently a paper by a very well-known Buddhist scholar called Alexander Wynn, and he is one of the disciples of Richard Gombrich, who was the professor of Sanskrit at Oxford University for several decades. And he has retired now, but Alexander Wynn is still a very active scholar. And he wrote a long paper, just came out just a few days ago, on why the Buddha is a historical figure. And he made a lot out of that particular point. Yeah, there are all these little things in there that don't make any sense unless you understand it as historical truth. And he was lambasting all these people who kind of say that we don't know anything about the Buddha. There are some academics who kind of claim this kind of nonsense. And he was really kind of making that point very strongly. And the reason he's able to make a good case is because he knows the suttas very well. There's actually, most academics don't know the suttas very well. They often kind of base themselves on ideas, not really having read it properly. But when you read them properly, there's all these little details in there that are really fascinating. And this is one of those little details that actually makes it real. When you read this the first time, you may not even think about it. Yeah, you may kind of bypass it as if it is completely irrelevant. But actually, little things like that matter. And they vouch for the historicity, if you like, or the historical truth of the suttas. Because the Buddha might have said that. For the Buddha, this may have been very important, yeah, to have a disciple who was able to know these things. And Ananda had done that to great effect to make sure that this actually mattered. So maybe from the Buddha's point of view, this actually was a very important quality, and that may be why he's saying it. I don't know. But that's... Yes, but Ananda... Yes. Okay, yeah. Some of the suttas actually came about, you're quite right, some of the suttas did come about like that, yeah. Yeah. Could be. There could be some larger idea behind this, which is you could be. I can't remember. My memory is not at the moment. It doesn't recall that part of it. But yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, so there may be some kind of something like that, yeah? And so that may very well be the case. So that he knows the right time so that you get a good discourse and you get kind of things. Yes, so exactly. So that might be the case, yeah? So that's good. Thank you for that, Ananda. That adds a little bit of flesh to the bones. The idea that there may be about taking people to the Buddha at the right time for a certain thing to happen, like a discourse being given, or the bhikkhun is being ordained, or knowing what is the right time and place so that things can happen in a certain way, and all of that. That might very well be the case. Yeah. On the other hand, okay. Yeah. Yes, that's coming soon, actually. Yeah. It's coming soon, one of those. Yeah. Yeah. Well, nobody's perfect. Yeah. There's no. Every rule has an exception. If it doesn't have an exception, it's not the rule. Is that right? Because if every rule has an exception, then if it doesn't have an exception, it can't be a rule. So it follows logically. Yeah. So otherwise, it wouldn't. No. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's why they get enlightened, had to do too many dirty jobs. Yeah, yeah. Having a hard time. Yeah. Yeah, anyway. So, yeah. We come to a case very soon. Very soon. I don't know what very soon means, because I don't know when we're going to have the next of these classes. It's not going to happen today, but one of these, well, if I'm still alive, then maybe it will happen. But let's continue a little bit longer. If you have to go, please feel free to go at any time, because I know I tend to carry on a little bit. So you have no obligation to be here or sit there. So always please feel free to go. Then the Buddha comes down to something which is maybe a little bit more natural to praise Ananda for. He keeps on praising him. Yeah, goes on. There are these four incredible and amazing things about Ananda. What for? If an assembly of monks goes to see Ananda, they are uplifted by seeing him and uplifted by hearing him speak. When he falls silent, they have never had enough. So, what does... when he is silent, they are disappointed, is what Maurice Walsh has here. Are you able to follow on the screen there, what I'm saying? Yeah? Okay, good. So it's a little bit different. I just like to give you different ideas. You can see slightly different translations, so give you different sort of vantage points on the same text. And then, if an assembly of nuns goes to see Ananda, they are uplifted by seeing him, uplifted by hearing him speak. And when he falls silent, they have never had enough. An assembly of laymen goes to see Ananda, an assembly of lay women. They are uplifted by seeing him, uplifted by hearing him speak. And when he falls silent, they have never had enough. These are the four incredible and amazing things about Ananda. So sometimes you have this feeling, I don't know if you had it before, you hear a good Dhamma talk and you get so into it and you kind of just, you know, you want it to go on because it is so nice to sit there and listening to the Dhamma. And this is how Ananda was all the time, it seems, always inspiring to listen to him, which is amazing. This is exactly what a good teacher should be about. This gives you some idea of a teacher should be inspiring, should be someone who explains the Dhamma clearly so it is interesting and draws you in. It should be uplifting, it should have all of these qualities. And this is what Venerable Ananda obviously had. So it's quite difficult to give a good Dhamma talk. Of course, the Dhamma talks can be many different qualities. It doesn't have to be kind of exactly the same and always wonderful. But ideally, to give the ideal Dhamma talk is actually quite hard. And Venerable Ananda obviously was an amazing Dhamma teacher. That's what is coming out here. That, of course, is very important and it's a very useful thing to have in the community here. There are these four incredible and amazing things about the wheel-turning monarch. What for? If an assembly of aristocrats, these are the Katyas, goes to see the wheel-turning monarch, they are uplifted by seeing him and uplifted by hearing him speak. And when he falls silent, they've never had enough. If an assembly of Brahmins goes to see the wheel-turning monarch, they are uplifted, etc. If an assembly of householders goes to see the wheel-turning monarch, if an assembly of ascetics goes to see the wheel-turning monarch, they are uplifted by seeing him, uplifted by hearing him speak. And when he falls silent, they've never had enough. In the same way, there are those four incredible and amazing things about Ananda. So, again, comparing Ananda to a wheel-turning monarch, obviously, this is very high praise, even though Venerable Ananda is an Arya and the wheel-turning monarch is not an Arya. Still, it obviously is quite special when you talk about wheel-turning monarchs, because they have a certain power that you don't have as an Aryan. So still, it is very, very high praise indeed. So again, the Buddha here lifting up Venerable Ananda, helping him out, to see things in the right way and overcome his sadness and sorrow that the Buddha is about to pass away here. Okay, let us go on a little bit. I'll go on to about 5:30, I thought, maybe, so a little bit more here. When he said this, Venerable Ananda said to the Buddha, now he has been overcome his sadness, and then he says to the Buddha, "Sir, please don't become fully extinguished in this little hamlet, this jungle hamlet, this branch hamlet. There are other great cities such as Champa, Rajagaha, Savati, Saketa, Kosambi, and Benares. Let the Buddha become fully extinguished there. There are many well-to-do aristocrats, Brahmins, and householders there who are devoted to the Buddha. They will perform the rites of venerating the realized one's corpse." So here, Venerable Ananda does not think that Kusinara is fit for the Buddha to pass away in this tiny little place. Kusinara was the capital of the Malan Republic. So it was a very small republic, and obviously this was almost like a village, probably. It was a very tiny little place, and the Buddha is about to pass away. And Venerable Ananda wants the Buddha to be passing away in a suitable place. And this was some of the great cities of ancient India. And even the great cities weren't that great. Things were very small scale at that time. Maybe they had a few thousand inhabitants. It's hard to say exactly how large, but they were not very big by contemporary standards. Even by the standards of just 150 or 100 years after the Buddha, when Pataliputra became the capital of the Magadhan Empire, became a vast city that is described in the descriptions of Megasthenes, who was the ambassador of King Seleucus, something like that, who was the Greek king of Persia at that particular time. And he was the ambassador to India. He was sent out, and he was in India about 300 BC, and he described Pataliputra as a magnificent city. There's actually still descriptions available in the present day and have been preserved in Greek to explain how magnificent it was. But at Buddha's time, everything was much more small scale. And this is where the Buddha wanted, Venerable Ananda wanted the Buddha to be, to kind of pass away here. Very briefly about those cities, this is a kind of standard set of six cities, and you will see, first of all, that Pataliputra is not mentioned there. The city that was to become so large soon after the Buddha passed away is not even mentioned here at all. Maybe 100 years after the Buddha, or even less, Pataliputra was already this magnificent place. 300 BCE, already very magnificent. At this point, it was no more than a village. I don't know if you remember when we were doing very much earlier on the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the Buddha was passing through what was called Pataligama. Pataligama was the early name of Pataliputra. And Pataligama literally means the village of Patali. At this time, it was merely an insignificant place in northern India, and the Buddha had never really been there. There's no record of the Buddha being there at all prior to the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. So it's really an obscure little place before that. That is quite interesting already. It gives you some idea of when these suttas were written. They were written prior to the arising of this grand Magadhan Empire with its big capital. It would have been very easy for later editors to add Pataliputra to this list. Because the later editors, they would have known that Pataliputra was becoming a big city. But they didn't do that. They didn't change these texts. And this is, again, a very powerful message to us, that these texts were actually kept intact from very early on, because it fits with the historical record, what we see in the suttas. They weren't altered, they weren't changed for purposes of you know, making people, giving people more faith because of, you know, they wanted to connect Buddhism to these grand cities or whatever. They were actually very conservative. They conserved these things pretty much as they were from the very beginning here. So that list is actually quite interesting here. Another city or town that you will see missing from that list is Kapilavastu or Kapilavatu. Yeah, it is not there. In the later Buddhist legend, Kapilavatu is talked about as a very large city where the Buddha grew up, and the king Suddhodana was his father, and he was the king of this place, and it was a magnificent capital. But that is much later. That is what you find in the Jataka Nidana, the origin to the Jatakas. This is the most famous place in the Pali Sutta, not Sutta, the Pali scriptures that talk about the life of the Buddha. That's where you find the whole mythology about the Buddha riding out on the horse Kantaka, jumping over the walls, yeah, or the grand walls of the Kapilavatu, and then free into the countryside. Yeah, this is kind of the story there. Very different from what you find in the suttas. So that is also missing here, which is what you would expect, because Kapilavatu at this time was probably no more than a large village. Yeah, maybe a few hundred, maybe a thousand, a couple of thousand people, something like that. I'm just guessing. I have no idea how large it was. With some fields around it. That was really all it was likely to have been. But what is interesting is that there is, as I mentioned before, a number of versions of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, one in Sanskrit, quite a few found in Chinese translation, in ancient Chinese. And one of the suttas in ancient Chinese has Kapilavatu as one of the cities. Yeah, so this, it doesn't have six cities, it has seven cities instead. This one only has six, the Sanskrit version only has six, but the one in Chinese has seven, and Kapilavatu has been added. And this shows you how sometimes these suttas are developed, how things sometimes are added later on, because the later tradition, everyone knows that Kapilavatu is a magnificent city, yeah, because that is what the mythology and the legend has given rise to. So because everyone knows that, it's missing. We need to add it. Yeah, well, how come it's not there? Everyone knows it's a big city. Okay, add it in. And then this is how these things kind of come about, that things get expanded later on. So again, it shows us that very, very often the Pali Suttas have been some of the most conservatively preserved of all the various traditions. Not always. Sometimes the Chinese may be a bit more conservative, but as a general principle, the Pali Suttas are probably the most conservative of all the suttas in preserving the original, the most original word, if you like, coming from the Buddha and coming from that particular climate and that particular society at that particular time. So, interesting. Also, these six cities in the Sanskrit version, there is a slight difference. In the Sanskrit version, instead of Kosambi, they have Vesali. We can see Vesali is missing from that list. And Vesali seems to have been a fairly large city at the time of the Buddha. Vesali was the capital of the Vajrayan Republic to the north of the Ganges River. And the Magadha was to the south of the Ganges River, with the Rajagaha as the capital there. So which one is right? Should it be Kosambi or should it be Vesali? And does it matter? Probably doesn't matter, yeah, it's very probably not so relevant. But what is interesting about Kosambi is that it is one of the few cities of ancient India that has been excavated by archaeologists. And the excavations go back almost to the time of the Buddha, and they have found basically a site of a town that is quite large, with large ramparts, yeah, large kind of walls, but no, everything made of earth, yeah, made of clay and earth. So at the most basic level, and so you know that this is the early cities prior to the Ashokan times, when everything was made of clay and earth, and they have the large walls going around the city. So Kosambi is one of the very few places that has been properly excavated in that way, and they have shown like the size of the city, and we know that it was a fairly large town at this particular time. So it seems quite likely that Kosambi should be on the list, and perhaps Vesali at this time was still relatively small and didn't really belong there. Anyway, it's just it doesn't really matter so much, but it is interesting that there is some archaeological evidence to corroborate the things that we find in the suttas once again. This is always nice to know that the archaeological record actually fits with what we read, and this is what we see in this particular case. But it is also interesting here, one of the points of this, of course, is why is it that Venerable Ananda wants the Buddha to to be cremated in one of these big cities. And the obvious answer is that the Venerable Ananda thinks that there is a prestige, in the prestige and being looked after by the well-to-do nobles and the well-to-do Brahmins and householders by these cities. It's prestige because they are capital cities, large places, prestigious places. Why on earth kind of go into the backwaters, the far away, back in the countryside somewhere, with all the, whatever in the countryside? It doesn't seem very prestigious. And you can see here the difference in thinking between Venerable Ananda and the Buddha. Presumably, the reason why the Buddha wants to die here is precisely because it is not prestigious. Precisely because it is a bit of a backwater. It is a reminder of what really matters in Buddhism. What matters in Buddhism is the spiritual qualities and the worldly qualities should always be in the background. So the Buddha probably prefers to be die in a simple place far away, which is very simple, so that the focus is fully on the spiritual qualities and not on the worldly qualities instead. That is one possible interpretation of what is going on here, whereas Ananda is still more worldly, as you might expect. He's still a stream entry, whereas the Buddha obviously has a different outlook. Another possibility is merely that the Buddha is just walking. He is not thinking at all about where he's going to die. He just walks, and then whenever he dies, he dies. That's another possibility. He's not really taking these things into account at all. But maybe not, on the other hand, because he was also very sick already at Vesali, so he could have chosen to die there if he thought that was important. But I think there is probably a very kind of natural and spiritual explanation for why this is going on. So quite likely that the Buddha wanted to tone down the kind of the worldly view of the importance of dying in the right place and instead focus on the spiritual qualities. And also much better for the Buddha, as we shall see later on, all the people in Kushinara, they want to come out and bow down to him and say goodbye. If he was in a big city, it would be a big hassle. You want to die. You want to get this over with. You don't want to kind of, hang out there, have all these people bowing down to you all the time. I can imagine the Buddha was having enough by now, and his body was wearing out, and he probably had to kind of keep himself alive for a little bit longer for everyone to have a chance to say goodbye. So a small crowd is better than a large crowd. So you can get this business over with.
Not
sure. You think it might be? It is there in all the versions of the various suttas. This passage is there everywhere. I think it. They were a small town in the way back, so they kind of all they were probably considered a bit like the kind of country hicks or something like that. Maybe I don't know, but they were also many of them were disciples of the Buddha and they were good Buddhists, So maybe the Buddha, I don't know, Hutonga.
I don't know. I think it's quite possible that it may happen, actually, personally. I think it may very well be right, because this is how people tend to think, They want to lift up the master and make the master into something special, and they say, why are you dying here? And so I think it's quite possible.
That is true. It is a little bit late. It's like he's lying on his grave and saying, please die somewhere else. That's a good point, actually. So he's kind of asking a little bit too much, perhaps. So Okay. And that is actually a good place to stop, I think. Yeah, because next is actually quite an interesting passage as well. Everything is very interesting. Yeah, and I hope you find it interesting as well, because I do. Yeah. But I think that is a good place to. Yeah, because now comes the reason. That what comes next, I guess, to give you a preview so you kind of know what's happening next. What comes next is the Buddha tells a story of why Kushinara is worthy of the Buddha's death. Yeah, because it needs to be worthy. And so we need to actually know why it is worthy. And to do that, we need a long mythological story and legend to explain why. And then, of course, it becomes acceptable after all to die in Kushinara. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been acceptable. So this is how the later Buddhist ideas, again, kind of make themselves felt in these ways. Yes, John?
It's working. Anyway, on the wheel-turning monarch.
Yeah.
The wheel usually in Buddhism refers to the Dharma wheel. The Dharma wheel?
Yeah.
So could these wheel-turning monarchs be specifically emperors like Asoka and some Chinese emperors who have actually done a lot to spread the Dharma?
It has been suggested by scholars that it refers to Ashoka. It has been kind of one of the suggestions. But I think the... I think the point is that there isn't very little evidence for that. If that was the case, then you would have expected Ashoka to call himself a wheel-turning monarch, but he doesn't actually really do that anywhere, apparently. He doesn't call himself that. And as we see throughout the suttas have always been finalized long before Ashoka anyway. This is a concept that seems to come from a time long before Ashoka. It's quite embedded in the suttas, the idea of the wheel-turning monarch, found in many different places. It has been a suggestion, but I think it has been shown fairly clearly. I think that actually doesn't really hold up to the evidence, because it actually existed well before Ashoka as part of the suttas. Yes, Bill. What? Wheel-turning monarch. I don't know about that. All I know is that Ashoka himself established a large number of stupas for the Buddha. Yeah, according to the story, there was after the Buddha. We'll see this later on when we come to the end of the Mahaparinirvana Sutta, that the relics were divided into 8 sections, and they went to the different countries. Then when Ashoka became a king, he dug it all out and put them in supposedly 84,000 stupas around India. Whether that is the case or not, I don't know, but that's kind of the legend of Ashoka. But whether Ashoka himself, I don't know, I never heard any evidence of that. Sure. Possibly, but I don't think there is any evidence of any stupas of Ashoka, as far as I know. Yeah. 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 Virtuous and Dhamma Raja, who acts according to Dhamma. Yeah, Dhamma Raja. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. 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 But yeah. 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 I think the idea is that the wheel-turning monarch is supposed to have conquered the land through Dhamma. Yeah, he just goes out and conquers without any warfare. Whereas Ashoka, the conquering that he did was very incredibly bloody. And he conquered the Kalinga kingdom in the east of India, and apparently hundreds of thousands of people were slaughtered. It was a very, very bloody warfare.
Yeah, but he didn't do any conquering after that. That was the end of his conquering here. Yeah, so he didn't do any of the kind of supposedly conquering that the wheel turning monarch is supposed to do by peace. That was the only conquering he did was bad. He did. So that was a kind of conquering here. Yeah, so maybe that was it. Yeah, but I don't think there is any evidence of him actually ever being considered a wheel turning monarch. Yeah, so I don't think that really is kind of by the by anyway here. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Everyone happy? Yeah? Are you sure you're happy? Yeah. Please. Yeah. 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 Uh-huh. Yeah, he I think he claims to have been Ashoka in a past life. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. 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 I don't know. I tend to be skeptical of these stories because they are so very unreliable, many of these stories. I've just heard so many stories, and I heard alternative versions of them, and then I've heard kind of where they come from, and it's just so unreliable. Some of them are interesting, and some of them may be true, but in general, I tend to be skeptical. I apologize for my skepticism, but that's the way I am. So, yeah. Okay. Okay. Good. So let's just pay respect to Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Yeah, please. Sorry. Okay, sorry. Questions from overseas. Okay, from outside. Okay, very good. Thank you for reminding me. That's very, very good. Okay. Okay, it's a question from the USA. Why the specifics of proper handling of the Buddha's corpse after the Parinibbana, despite his teaching on impermanence and the unattractiveness of the body? What is the significance of relics? yes, it is true, and of course the Buddha, in many ways, he says not to worry about the Buddha's body, especially said that to the monks, forget about the Buddha's body, because the real Buddha is actually in his attainment, it's in his mind. The mind is what the Buddha really is about. So the body in many ways is irrelevant. But I think we have seen what the reason is. The reason is that it is still possible to gain some joy and happiness if you think about the Buddha's remains in the right way. It's a bit like traveling on a pilgrimage to India, and when you go there, you can actually get some of this joy and piti arising because you are walking in the Buddha's footsteps. It becomes more real when you go to the places where the Buddha was. When you sit in the kind of in Australia or the USA, you're very far away from these places, and it's kind of more difficult to get a feeling for the Buddha and a feeling for what is going on. But when you go to these places and you see that they look exactly as they are described in the suttas, and you get some of the vibes of these places, because I don't know whether it's just a subjective feeling or whether it's a real feeling, I don't know, it doesn't really matter, but you get some of that vibe, it can be very powerful. And this is the purpose. The purpose is actually to connect you to the teachings in a certain way, and especially the four holy places and the Buddha, but perhaps also sometimes a stupa, which has real relics in it. I have to admit that I think there's far too many relics in the world these days, and far too much kind of worshipping of dodgy relics. I have this theory that if you add all the relics that are available in the world, you get a mountain of relics, far bigger than the Buddha's body could ever have been. That's kind of my skeptical theory here. And the chances of all these relics appearing 2,500 years after Buddha, it all seems a little bit dodgy to me. But anyway, that's just me. Some of them may be real. And some of the realest relics that are available have actually been found in certain ancient stupas, and they are kept in the present day in places like the museum in New Delhi, for example. And they have very good pedigree, and there's good reason for thinking that might actually be the real bones of the Buddha. They don't look like relics, they actually look like bones, and they look more real. And of course, if you have the real bones of the Buddha, and you think there's a good reason for them being there, and you put them in a stupa, then it becomes very powerful again. So there is that point, but I agree with you, there tends to be too much, I think, personally, too much relic worship, and people become obsessed by relics as if this is kind of the be-all and end-all almost of Buddhism sometimes. But really, it should only be there as an inspiration, something that aids you on the path and not something that is a goal in its own right. So practice is always a thing in Buddhism, and only insofar as the relics aid you in your practice is it really worthy of consideration. Yeah. So just remember that. Okay. Next one. This is from Sri Lanka. Venerable Ajahn said, the wheel-turning monarch is a mythical person that did not really exist in the world, but in this sutta, he is one of the persons worthy of erecting a stupa. Yes, and my thinking is that because he was a mythical person, he was known in Indian society, even though he may not have existed, he was known as a mythological figure. People understood that this was someone who was very, very elevated. So because they could relate to that mythology, they could kind of place the Buddha in the context of that myth, if you like. So if the wheel-turning monarch, even if there had never been one, the fact that he was understood as a certain type of person meant that the Buddha could be understood in relation to that wheel-turning monarch. That is my theory. There is very little evidence that such wheel-turning monarch existed in India, because India was never a unified country before Ashoka. Ashoka was the first one and the last one really to fully unify India. And before that, India was just a country with large number of kingdoms and republics. And before those republics, it was just a very rural and agrarian society ruled by Brahmins largely before that. So there is very little evidence to think that there ever was such a king, and is more kind of seems more likely that it was based on mythology and legend rather than real historical events. Yeah, that's the way I see it. Okay, next question is from Germany. If faith leads you to higher realms and reincarnation, then does love make it possible to have the same partner for many lifetimes? Is love the binding force? Yes, are you trying to get some ideas here on how to kind of carry on? It is possible to have the same partner in many lifetimes. There's actually a sutta about that. There's a sutta about everything, as I like to say. And there's a sutta about that where the Buddha, where Nakula Pita, Nakula Mata, they go to the Buddha, and they say to the Buddha, oh, we love each other so much. They were both tree mentors. Yeah, they had such an incredibly good relationship. Not only do we want to be together in this life, we also want to be together in the future life. What should we do? They obviously were very close. Yeah, and they really kind of attached to each other, whatever you want to call it, or loved each other or whatever. And the Buddha says, well, what you should do if you want to be reborn together in the future life, attachment is not enough. Attachment is only one factor. The other factor is you need the same kind of kamma. So you need to have the same qualities in terms of faith, learning, virtue, wisdom, and generosity, I think. Something like that. Five qualities, roughly those five qualities. And if you have those five qualities are the same, that means your kamma is basically the same. So when your kamma is the same and your attachment is the same, bang, you come together again in a future life. That's what you have to do. So there you are. That's the formula for being reborn together in the future life if you really have a good time together. So if you don't want to be reborn together, if you don't want to have the same partner's life, make sure you have different kamma, yeah? And then you people have different desires, what's going to happen in the future. Anyway,